Welcome to episode 48 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
So we're recording on December 1st.
And that went really smoothly.
Compared to our last one.
So, okay. We haven't done a podcast in a long time, and it's too bad, but we just were too busy.
But we're back.
We're going to make an effort, get back on the, because we're doing it every 2 weeks for like over a year. And so there's a whole bunch of reasons that this has been more difficult, but but we're really excited to get it going again. And we even just started, we recorded one midweek.
We did.
And it was so bad.
That we decided to save you.
Yeah. So this is a redo of
that. Of a redo.
Yeah.
What do you have on your agenda this week to look at?
To look at for this podcast. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I mean, because we haven't done one in a while, there's articles from that go back for over a couple months that I looked at just real quick.
Okay.
And you want to, I guess we'll do our literature first, right?
Okay.
So where is it? So I don't know what you want to do, but let me, you decide on something that you're not going to do. So there's the...
I focused on two, which I shared with you. So I focused on the flu vaccine and the mini satellites.
Okay, so what would you like? I could do Oumuamua. I could do the bot hunters with the German elections.
I'm kind of interested in the bot hunters.
The bot hunters. Okay.
And the chemistry one.
The chemistry is.
I started this, that one.
That one. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Okay, so we're going to have two of them. Bot hunters and... let's not do the chemistry one. I don't have much.
Okay.
I looked at it for a bit, but it's been a while now.
Okay, so and, tell me about the bot hunters.
Okay, and then we can look at some of the others. Mm-hmm. So this is a news piece out of AAAS Science from September 15th, and it's from page 1081. And basically, it was talking about all the research that's happening now because, so we have this phenomenon of programs masquerading as real people and connecting to social media and creating news, but it's just totally made up.
Right.
And it's for the purpose of some goal that the programmers have set up. And the most interesting one is, of course, when they're trying to influence elections.
Right.
So for the U.S. elections and the French elections, I guess there was a lot going on, but the researchers hadn't really vamped up their effort back then. And the German elections went on, but back then they hadn't gone on yet. And so they were doing all sorts of stuff to try to get ready to see what effect it could have. And the interesting thing is that it seems to be kind of an arms race between the people that write the bots and the people that are doing the research.
Right.
So, for example, in the beginning, basically, you'd be like, okay, so I want to influence this election, so I'm going to write this program, and it's going to tweet on Twitter every minute, let's say. Well, it's not every minute, but like I think they had a thing of more than 50 times a day is one of the criteria that the researchers had set out early on
for to detect bots.
Yeah, which isn't necessarily going to like early on that worked really well, but it also included a lot of people that were not bots.
Right.
And it also missed a lot of bots. But generally, it seems like that criterion worked really well at getting gross numbers of, you know, how many, what fraction of, well, that's even a bad way to look at it. Okay. It seemed to work well.
Right.
From whatever ways they had to grade their success, and that I did not see. So then, you know, the people writing the bots, right, because it's a program, you can make it tweet as often as you want. So you come up with some really simple thing. It's going to tweet negative stuff about a particular candidate, and it's going to send out a tweet once every 30 minutes, let's say, right? So that would be 24 times 240. So it'd be more than that, I guess, to get over that 50. So that's basically what they're doing, because that's easy. And, you know, that might be the first thing you think about. And why make it more complicated? Who's going to know, right? But, of course, the researchers find this out, right? They think, they try to put themselves in the shoes of the bot writers. And so they try to differentiate between who's real and who's not. And then they write papers about what's happening.
Right.
And then the people, and that goes into the news, and the people writing the bots see that. So they on purpose
try to
to
make it different and stand out as a unique individual.
Exactly. And the one reason we know this is happening is because after that criterion of 50 came out, supposedly, suddenly a whole bunch of entities, let's say, we'll call them entities, we don't know what they are, started to tweet at just under 50 a day. So it's, anyway, and so they're getting more complicated, and then the researchers are getting better tools, and then the bot writers are coming up with things.
Right.
And they go around this. And
so an arms race.
It's, and I mean, it was really interesting. I can't remember the second time I looked over the article. It made sense to me that it's not certain, but it seemed like it was a relatively small number of bot writers that were making a huge effort at influencing elections all over the world. I can't remember exactly what the reason was, but it made sense at the time, just from the data. Another thing that was interesting was that, you know, one of the things you want to know is, well, who's doing this?
Right.
And the what you see in the news about people saying, oh, it's Russia or China, you know, that knee-jerk response is exactly what you'd, you know, that can be discounted immediately. Because, for example, if you're a Canadian wanting to influence the U.S. elections, you're going to leave traces in your message as if it was written by a Russian. I mean, that's just so obvious, right? So just because there's indications from the way tweets are coming out that
so
are...
So the smoke screen.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to be a lot more sophisticated than that to figure out where they really come from.
Right.
Even though that's what hits the news. Anyway, that's actually kind of sad the way it's hitting the news that way, because it seems really obvious what would be happening.
Right. It's and I think, you know, it's one of those learning curves that everybody has to go through.
So let me look. You were interested in the chemistry one. Let me just see if I remember.
Okay. While you're looking through that, I can give a short one that just caught my eye from the news. So, from the news, December 1st, 2017, just this morning at 8 a.m., Mom, should you eat your placenta? Your placentas, like after the afterbirth, after delivery.
Yeah.
And I have to say, it kind of attracted me because I remember having this discussion with people in University Village when we were having kids. And so I was just like, wow, what did they find out? So they did this blind study, and they looked at, you know, women who eat the placenta opposed to women that don't. And they found out that it doesn't have any effect, that it's a placebo effect that's making people feel that they don't have depression after they deliver or other side effects. So I just thought it was kind of a quick and fun little study that was put on. And having someone that's ready to give birth anytime, I have to go back to school and tell her, just because I know she'll be interested. Anyway, so back to you.
Yeah, I don't remember much about this one. You know, it's one of those deep sea chemistry articles.
I only read the first part of it. I have to say this article interests me because of the deep sea environment.
Yeah.
And they mentioned a sub-alvin that I had actually seen.
Yeah. I mean, the article is not so much about all that's happening as the fact that so if someone's interested, it's from September 22nd in AAAS, and it's page 1223. But it's it's really about, at the time of the discovery, there was really no understanding of how many different communities live without having the photoautotrophs be the base of the food chain.
Right.
And now we see all, so it's not just in the ocean, but it's mostly in the ocean that this is interesting.
Yeah, with extremophiles, where you have bacteria that live in extreme environments.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And now all this technology has been worked on for, what, almost 40 years? And so now all this research is going on, and, you know, entire communities living around just carcasses that have gone to the bottom of the ocean and in certain other extreme environments. And this idea that it seems like the flow of chemicals, and specifically of chemicals in different oxidation states, goes in and out of the center of the extreme environment, like, so for these hot vents in the ocean, and you have communities in rings around that, right?
Right.
And around the closest ring uses one chemical, and the next ring around uses what the inner one excreted that it couldn't use, but then the next one can use without being exposed to such extreme environment, and then the next one after that. And you have things like, if I remember, there's a mussel, as an example, that has bacteria that live in its gills. And I'm trying to remember, because if I start looking for it, it's going to take forever. But there's, I don't know, like, I'm going to make it up, 100 or 1,000 different bacterial species in that ring, right? But this one mussel only has one bacterial species living in its gills. So people are like, wow, this is like such a simple relationship, just the one and the other, and they must be perfectly matched. But then
very specialized.
Yeah, but then they look closer and they realize, but there's two strains of bacteria. And one bacterium excretes something that it can use, but it can't use it fast enough, as fast as it's making it. And the other one can use it. And it's not just oxidation state. It's nitrogen fixation and other types of chemical handling that happens in these rings. So,
Neat.
Just all that's known.
Well, would you like to go over, keeping it on a biological vein?
Sure.
Did you want to go over to why is the flu vaccine so mediocre?
I thought that was a fascinating one.
Yes.
So you take it.
Okay. I read this fairly quickly, so please help me out as I go through it.
I read that one carefully, so
yeah.
I mean, it was a while ago, but
this is in the infectious disease part of Science. It is from the September 22nd, 2017 issue. And of course, it interests us right around flu season, because everybody's getting their flu shot, and oh my goodness, have you had yours yet? You better go get it. And the article is written by John Cohen, and it goes over the influenza vaccine and how effective it is. And basically, you know, it's been pretty effective in some years, and in other years, it's plunged down to almost 10% effective.
Yeah,
which is like, oh my goodness, you're kidding. You know, so it was, you know, and of course, in the office and that, you're always hearing, yeah, I don't get the flu shot. I got it once and I got the flu really bad. It's just not worth it. I think I got the flu from it. You know, and so you have all these crazy conversations going on around you. This kind of sheds light for me for how the vaccine is not as effective in some situations and more effective in others. And I thought it was interesting how the virus growing in an egg, that the eggs adapted a mutation, and so that there was more chances for the changing of that the vaccine during the development, or maybe I misread it. Hope I didn't misread it. I'm going to go read your take on. I'll just make sure I check what I'm saying.
What I can mention, I mean, what I find, there's so many fascinating things about this article, but I think the first thing to understand about this low efficacy in some years.
No, I was right. HR factor in the egg-grown vaccine caused...
Oh, wait a second. You're looking around here somewhere.
Yeah.
But that's totally makes no sense. That someone just wrote it incorrectly.
Oh, okay.
Right? He also points to a recent study by another group that compared egg-grown vaccine with one that contained genetically engineered HA. Well,
right.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Which sidesteps the mutation issue. It's like, okay, well, we didn't explain what the mutation issue is,
we'll
but I think that...
Describe the article.
We found one, either a mistake in the article or something that was written without any explanation.
Right. But in general, they were saying that the vaccine that was genetically engineered is more efficient in dealing with the virus than the one that's grown in egg.
Yeah, that's where the sentence makes no sense.
Okay.
Because they're saying, go back to the sentence, they're saying egg-grown vaccine with one that contained genetically engineered HA. There's no HA in the vaccine.
Okay.
HA, hemagglutinin, is what the vaccine attacks. Right? It's
right. Okay. So let's continue on with what the article, you got from the article.
Yeah,
so we don't focus too much on the mistake.
Yeah. So I mean, it might not be a mistake. It might just be, it's not explaining what it's... Well, it sounds like... Anyway, so let's... Yeah. I think the first step in understanding what it's trying to say, the biggest thing that we're starting to realize now is why it's not as efficacious in some years.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea has always been like, oh, this is a really bad year because... we have to guess. It takes so long to grow the vaccine in quantities that are high enough to inoculate the entire population. And so you have to guess way early what's the strain that's going to hit you, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes we guess wrong.
Right.
So then the flu arrives, and it's not the one that everybody got vaccinated against.
Right.
And what this article is saying, no, that's not true. That's not the problem. It's not that we're guessing wrong, because even when they guess right, sometimes it's only 10% efficacious. Mm-hmm. And what's really happening is that, well, one possibility is that the way the vaccine is grown is it's basically a live mm-hmm. flu, and it's grown in eggs. Mm-hmm. So you basically guess on what strain from people that are being sick around the world. And mm-hmm. like, okay, this is the one that's really expanding this year. And you isolated that, you put it in an egg, and mm-hmm. you grow it. And then you break open your egg. I mean, they don't do it. They have some way of doing it. But basically, right. and you take everything that's grown in that egg, and you put a little bit in 100 eggs, a little bit of each, right? So now you have 100 eggs that are growing virus. Mm-hmm. And then when they're just full of virus, you break all of them, and you put a little bit in each of 1,000 eggs, right?
Right.
And then you isolate it after you have 10 million eggs, I don't know, and you isolate the virus and you attenuate it so it doesn't make people sick, and you inject it into them. Mm-hmm. And then we recognize the virus, right? And we make antibodies against it. Mm-hmm. Mostly, what's really important is not so much we make antibodies, but our B cell colonies that are good at recognizing those hemagglutinin is on the virus. I'm the one who misspoke there. Mm-hmm. But that recognize the hemagglutinin on the virus, they start to expand. And actually, that's one point that I don't totally understand about the article. But anyway, and so then when we get hit with true influenza virus that's virulent, well, we have lots of B cells there, and they crank out antibodies, and we can stop it. Mm-hmm. And what the article is saying is what's actually happening is when you take that virus that you first isolate and you put it in your very first egg, right, it's going to divide a whole bunch of times.
Right.
And it might mutate. And even if it doesn't mutate that first time, then you put it in, you break open your egg when it's full of virus, and you put in 100 eggs, let's say, or I don't know, mm-hmm. probably 1,000, then it might mutate then. Now, imagine a situation where it takes 100 steps until you have enough virus.
Right.
If a couple of them mutate in the last step, well, you have a couple groups in the world that don't get good virus because it's got mutated, but pretty much that's a good year. Mm-hmm. But if just by chance it happens to mutate in one of the first two steps, most of the vaccine out there is not the strain.
The viable.
It's not even the strain that you were looking for.
Right.
So that was really interesting. Yeah, what I didn't totally understand, they're looking specifically at, I don't want to go into something that I don't understand here. There was some really interesting parts, there's interesting things to think about, is that the vaccine we're mostly focused on, for some reason, mm-hmm. we're able to make sure that it's targeting the hemagglutinin on the virus. Mm-hmm. But there's two proteins on the virus.
Right.
And it's specifically the hemagglutinin head that we're right. focusing on, and that's got a really variable region. And that's just there to hook on to where it's going to bind to our cells and get in. I don't know as much about the hemagglutinin, but it also has a sialidase on there. And the sialidase is there to cut up sugars that are on the molecules that line our airways to get through to, so it can get to the cells. Mm-hmm. And that's exciting for me. Oh, sorry, they call it neuraminidase. So right. Neuraminidase and sialidase are the same thing. Just mm-hmm. two different names for the same type of enzyme. But it's not just influenza that has sialidase or neuraminidase. And it's one of the things I'm researching right now.
Oh, neat. Very
I have, nice. Yeah, I have some... it's basically an enzyme that will cleave off sialic acids from the tips of sugar molecules on all sorts of proteins, mm-hmm. but in particular mucins, which line the airways. And so one idea is that maybe those are involved in the way that the mucus is cleared from the airway. And so maybe how fast the mucus can move or not move depends partially on those surface sialic acids. And so I've been doing research with both some sialidase from a couple different sources, not influenza, I don't think, and also other molecules that inhibit the production of sialidase in the cell, and doing some experiments on how fast ciliary propelled mucus flows.
Neat.
With fluorescent beads. Yeah, it's
really
a cool,
neat.
Cool thing. So.
Okay. So, should we make the switch to the mini satellites?
Sure.
Okay. Now we're going to do a tech portion. And this one is on CubeSats. And this comes from an issue of September 29th, 2017 from Science. And it's by Joshua Sokol, the article. And the article's name is Mini Satellite Surge Spurs Downlink Infrastructure.
And infrastructure.
Infrastructure, pardon me. And it's really kind of blows my mind because, you know, we had done something on Cube satellites a few years ago. And then to hear that they have grown so much that they overflow the download options.
So maybe we should explain what's happened.
Yeah. Okay. We'll back up and start with what's happened. So what has happened, Patrick?
Me? It's your mm-hmm. cool.
Well, because you seemed
because
excited.
I said.
Yeah.
Well, so I can't remember. It says early 2000s. I don't remember when I first remembered CubeSats becoming popular, but
yeah, early 2000s.
At the time, all they did was got sent up and mm-hmm. transmitted a tiny bit of data. The idea was just like, wow, can we really make these tiny little satellites and piggyback mm-hmm. them on big payloads and not spend $1 billion every time you want to put one up, right?
And get some pretty cool data.
At the time, it was just a concept. Can we even do this? And oh, by the way, let's send back something like,
right,
you know, I don't know, magnetic field reading or something that you could do with a tiny little sensor. Mm-hmm. Except the power of this approach of sending out many satellites and not worrying so much about them failing has been so fantastic that just tons of people have gotten into the game, both companies
and researchers.
Mm-hmm. And now there's all these satellites out there, and they're really packing them with every sensor they can get in there. And those satellites are trying to send the data back to Earth. And the receiving stations on Earth are absolutely swamped. Mm-hmm. And so you have some companies like Planet Labs that have decided, fine, we're going to build our own downlink stations mm-hmm. all over the world. And the reason you have to do it all the world is because these guys are in very low Earth orbit.
Right.
So they're flying around, which means as they go overhead, when they connect to a downlink station on Earth, they have to really book getting their data down because pretty soon they're going to be over the horizon.
Right.
And they're going to have to connect to a different one.
Right.
So you want them all over. So Planet Labs, I guess, is building them in all over the world. And then there's some companies that have just grown up just mm-hmm. to build download stations and then rent them out. In particular, researchers, right? They're in this situation where they don't have this company where that's going to be doing stuff all the time. They write a proposal, and it's like, hey, we're going to do this research because now you can put up CubeSats for cheap, and we're going to do that, and we're going to get this data. And the proposal comes in, and it's like, yes, okay, go ahead. And they build them, and they send them up, and they can't get the data back.
So they have KSAT out of Norway.
Okay.
Commercial companies. And there's Leaf Space and Spaceflight Networks, which are Swedish organizations. And all of them are providing download sites for data.
So, well, go ahead.
And I just thought it was cool that this whole, you know, economy built up. Around the need
on Earth because of us being able to put up the CubeSats and how useful it became.
And the diversity of uses that people have for it, anyone from NASA to research, and they're paying like big bucks for this the downloads. Like,
it's cheap to put up a CubeSat compared to what we call a real satellite, in air quotes, but it's still really expensive to put up a CubeSat. So you're going to pay big time to get your data back down.
Right. And there's this one satellite company that offers downloads a little cheaper. And they were saying that they were paying $6,000 for, you know, some download. Mm-hmm. And it was 10 times cheaper than some of the other companies.
Cool.
So it's just like there's a lot of competition. And
did you notice there was one company that kind of went back the opposite direction with satellites in order to support the CubeSats?
Yes, that was the cell phone company that mentioned, the Globalstar satellite. They're like,
so they put it in a higher Earth orbit.
Right.
And so the idea is basically, if I understand it correctly, a CubeSat might not be able to see the Earth station, any one Earth station, for very long.
Right.
But it can see a satellite higher up a hell of a lot longer. And the satellite that's higher up will itself be able to see stations on the ground for a much longer time because it's higher up.
Mm-hmm.
So its horizon doesn't come as fast. And, and of course, its orbital speed doesn't have to be as fast if it's higher up.
Right.
So, done with our literature? I see you clicked on our site. So
I did. I clicked over to our site to...
So we haven't been around doing podcasts for a super long time.
No.
And so maybe we should talk about everything. We can't talk about everything we've done.
No.
But...
So in the last, between September and the end of October, we did 4 ARTIF events in the fall for the school, and we had a lot of fun.
3 80-meter classics and 1 fox ring. Mm-hmm. Our first fox ring ever.
Woo-hoo! Okay.
But even before that, so what? The reason we were able to do the fox ring is we finally built the fox. Maybe we should go that at the end when we talk about building and stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
So we did fox ring.
Right.
But before that, we did the Cincinnati Championships in Ohio.
We did. We did. So we've had a very busy year.
And it was your first ever?
It was my first ever event.
Yep.
And why not go big and do a national event?
Well, that's the only kind you can do.
It is. It was a lot of fun, and people are very welcoming and understanding of new people.
So I brought a few pictures for you to see.
Yep.
Bob Evans dinners with everybody.
Yep. And you are busy from what? We'd wake up at 7, and we would go right through till 9.
Yeah.
And then we would do the same thing the next day.
Yeah.
And we were constantly going out. It was a lot of fun. We were...
It's basically you get all your gear together.
Yeah.
Then you go to the event.
Mm-hmm.
You go there early because you want to make sure everything's set. And then you run the event.
Mm-hmm.
And then you help with pickup.
Right.
And then you go to dinner with everybody. And
Yeah. So you are active the whole time. And it's wonderful to be out and be active with everyone.
Made some new friends from Australia. Oh, I have their picture up and I can't find them anymore. But let me see. Ewan and Jack.
Yep.
Do you remember Jack on Fox Ring? He wouldn't.
Yeah.
He didn't use the map. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Which was crazy. Yeah. He was there somewhere. Anyway.
And he had actually put on several events, international events, for their area.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they were very active. The couple was retired, and that's what they did. They went to RDF events for
Ewan
fun ways.
And Janelle?
Yep. Yeah. They traveled around. And they were very positive and active, and it was fun to be with
them. How did you like your new receiver?
And I got a wonderful new receiver, and I barely knew how to use it, and I got out there using it in the field, and it was really good. And in fact, I'm just now starting to appreciate all of the options that it offers. Yeah. I couldn't possibly use them when
it was more sensitive.
Time. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was cool.
Very nice. So we had a good experience in the fall. So how about onto the building?
Should we mention at least we also put on an extra BOK event?
Oh, we did. Yes, we put on an extra BOK event to keep interest in the BOK community.
Because that was your push.
Yeah, it was, because I wanted to make sure that people were able to come out and continue doing some RDF.
We actually had very few people show up on that one.
We did. It was a cold day, I have to say, and kind of rainy.
That's true. Yeah.
And so it might have been the weather. We had a few hardy souls that showed up, and all of them were very excited about RDF.
Yeah.
And always are. So they're always looking for opportunities to be out.
Anyway, and then, so we had the school ones. Mm-hmm. We had the BOK annual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a whole year planned out.
Right, which is always a little, frightening to see all written out. And you're like, wow, yeah. And of course you do it, but it's funny to do a whole year in a 2-hour, 3-hour section of an evening. So it always kind of, a little overwhelming.
Okay. Building?
Yep, building.
So if you go to the event report for October 22nd,
mm-hmm.
I started adding at some point small secondary pages that you can link from in there with equipment notes. And it shows a bunch of our new Fox Ring transmitters. Bob Frey, who was at the Cincinnati, Ohio Championships, was helping to run them, gave us the schematic, which is a common one, I think, is being mm-hmm. used. Did 3D printing for the first
right.
time.
Right, that was huge.
Local guy, Brian Henning, mm-hmm. out of Raleigh, has a 3D Hubs mm-hmm. page, and so that was interesting.
We were very happy with his work, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's for the prototype, it's expensive. For the prototyping, it's definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm.
At the last minute, we ran out of time and we had to build some. We went to Lowe's and got some stuff, and
mm-hmm.
it actually turned out to be way clunkier and heavier.
It did.
Although we were using PLA, and either we need to go the thicker or ABS because...
Right, and that's what I was just about to say. However, the sturdiness of the 3D printed material, we may have to change up the plastics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so we have enough to do Fox Ring. Mm-hmm. And, well...
A funny story.
Yeah.
So... we're about to do a Fox Ring. Pat and I went out the day before. I guess just you went out the day before. And he was posting the Fox Ring. He was putting out the posts and that.
Yeah.
And so that he could do a run the next morning and place all the foxes out. And at that evening, we did a nido.
Yep.
And we were out in the same forest doing a nido. And one of the people came back and they're like, hey, we found your number five.
That was Joseph, I
yeah,
think.
Yeah, Joseph.
Who's head of, who's yeah. Director or head or whatever for BOK.
Right.
So,
and so we were laughing
yeah.
about
yeah,
no, it.
Yeah,
it
was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, so moving on, I mean, one of the major reasons the website is just so woefully falling behind is because we really want to get the capability to do all the ARDF.
Mm-hmm.
And we're close, but it's a lot of work.
It is.
And then when we go to run events, suddenly everything else comes to a crawl. Was it Thanksgiving weekend? I can't remember exactly when finally. I had several huge successes.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was at the end of Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah. And basically, it's working on the 2 meter transmitters. And I was working so hard to get those done, and it just nothing was working. And finally, I got amplitude modulation of a RF
mm-hmm.
sine wave using some audio frequency. It's the amplitude modulation is not really sine wave-ish, but last night I put everything on one board and it looked a lot cleaner than in the past, and I think we're going to mm-hmm. go ahead and start building them.
Yeah.
So the audio frequency is not super sine-like, but it's probably good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the crazy things, and this is a story that I've told two people already, but, well, three including you, but I had an RF choke that I'd selected for the 80 meter transmitters, and I'd been reading about all the different components and about self-resonant frequency of chokes. And so their impedance is really high as you get close to the self-resonant frequency. So that's a good place to be, just under it, mm-hmm. if you really want to cut something down. But I'd have thought, I don't totally understand the whole theory, but I thought, you know, as long as you're below that somewhere, it's going to work. And so at the time, not knowing any better, I'd selected a choke with a very high self-resonant frequency. I think it was 30 gigahertz, with the idea that there is no way I can just use this for everything and mm-hmm. just not worry about it. And I'm looking at this data sheet and I'm like, wait, it says 30 megahertz. Now, 2 meters is at 144 megahertz, and above the self-resonant frequency, the inductor becomes a capacitor. So it's doing the exact opposite, right?
Right.
And, yeah, so I'd taken a screenshot of DigiKey the time I bought it, and, yeah, it says 30 megahertz. The data 30 gigahertz. The data sheet says 30 megahertz. I bring up that DigiKey for that part today, and it says 30 megahertz. So basically, I was creating all of this RF, sending it out, and sending it right to ground through the choke. And then after another part in the circuit, I was trying to measure it, and there was nothing there. So, mm-hmm. yeah. Anyway, got some new chokes. Mm-hmm. that are a lot better, and I'm sure there were some other issues, but we have it, and mm-hmm. I think I wrote a news piece on the podcast about our success, if I remember correctly. Let's see. No, I just written we're back, but anyway. Mm-hmm. I did write a little bit about 2 meter. No, just about our plans. Anyway, so Yeah, it's the design that we've settled on temporarily is a combination of Rick Strobe in Germany and David Dean in the UK, plus things we've talked to people here about in the States. They're common designs for ARDF. The audio frequencies generated by basically a quad gate CD4093. I think it's quad, two input NAND. And the RF is by the ICS525, which is basically a PLL chip that multiplies a crystal signal. So, yeah, and I mean, so far it looks okay. So we're designing the, we've got a schematic, we're designing our Osh Park boards, and I was hoping I'd get them out today, but that, there's just no way, I realized a little while ago. So, but the signal looks really pretty good. Yeah. Hopefully we'll have them built by sometime in the spring, enough to do an actual event.
Mm-hmm. And we're still waiting to hear about where the U.S.
where the U.S. championships are going to be in 2018.
Yeah.
So
we will.
I was really hoping for Oregon.
I was too.
Because we've never had an event up there.
I'm like, yes, I want to go to the Cascade Mountains.
So one of the friends, I mean, I knew him before, but that you made when we were at Cincinnati was Jay Hennigan.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moved up to Oregon, and he seemed really excited to put one on.
Yeah, so I hope he gets his way.
And he put a, just as a side note here, since we're on it, he put a plan for a 2-meter antenna with pictures and how to construct it for ARDF. And that's basically, well, I just put the last stuff that I needed, the order right before the podcast for McMaster Car, since... I still need some cable and something from Amazon. But, you know, now that the 2-meter, like, we bought the rods already. We got some brass and some bronze rod to experiment with. And now that the 2-meter transmitter, the circuit board, you know, the ugly construction one is working, then it's worth getting the rest of the stuff and making an antenna because, you know, I mean, I can hear the circuit board going into a dummy load with the RDF receivers. Just nice. Across the room. So.
Nice.
We are ready.
So, future plans, more building.
Yeah, I think we kind of talked about the future
plans. We did. So, it is time to wrap it up.
Just one thing.
Oh, yes.
I think we really should mention the eclipse.
Oh, yeah. We had so much fun.
Absolutely a fantastic thing
to
see.
It was. If it is well past the time... But if ever you have an opportunity to see a full eclipse, it is
because
stunning.
We'd seen partial before.
We had,
and
we
it's
had,
not even,
it's not the, even close.
No,
and we just had a really awesome spot to see them in. We were by a lake, so that we had this huge open area.
Yeah.
We were in a park surrounded with the most diverse group of people I've ever seen, which was also wonderful.
The one thing is, I kept talking about this before. You see so many pictures of astronomical objects, and the images have been modified in order so you can see what's interesting, right? Which is good.
Right.
You want to understand what's out there, and so you have to modify it so you can see what you're talking about, right? And there's been so many pictures of solar eclipses, and you see all the corona.
Right.
But, and you know, obviously you can't see the corona unless the moon is exactly the size or very close to the size of the sun. Because if it's too small, the sun shines through and blinds you. And if it's too big, it masks the corona.
Right.
So it's got to be exactly that. And you don't know before you see it for the first time, well, how much are these pictures enhanced compared to...
Yes.
Am I just going to barely be able to see
anything
by
squinting? Is this just
going to
be like, oh, great, bye.
Is it even not even going to be there?
Right.
No.
It was incredible. It's
the corona, the way you see it, is actually a stronger effect than any picture you've ever seen.
Right.
Because, of course, the...
I'll agree with that.
The dynamic range of your eye, right? Mm-hmm. A picture can't match what your eye can accommodate to,
right?
And the black where the sun has been masked, and suddenly everything else, not having the reflection of the sun all through the earth around you, makes it that you can see this corona, and it's just there, and it's just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
I agree.
Anyway. So, yeah. Future plans. And did you have anything for... I actually don't understand what you have there.
No, I'm not sure what this is.
Okay, something from an old podcast.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Future plans are basically build the 2-meter mm-hmm. transmitters, reprogram our 80-meter... We have lots of stuff. We have changes in battery mm-hmm. connections, rechargers for the 80-meter receivers, and possibly course timing system if there's time. So,
mm-hmm.
And then a trip to Canaan Valley in mm-hmm. West Virginia for yep. Christmas, which will be a lot of fun with Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... that's maybe all we should mention now, because
yeah.
it's so much between now and the next podcast. If we do it in 2 weeks, we'll have already done so much more. Who knows
right.
what we'll be doing
right.
with 2 meters and stuff. Now that we're, you know, up till this time, it's been, what, 2 years that we've made almost no progress?
right, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So. Okay, so... thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast that is back.
Yes, and make sure to check out our blog for building.
As soon as I update it again, which will happen
soon,
before actually this podcast goes out, because I have a whole week, right, to put
it
out. So, okay.
Goodbye.